What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Beth Allison Barr. So I just checked the email that I initially sent to Beth, and I sent it last year, June 26th, about doing this interview. So I've been prepping and getting ready for this interview for almost a year, because I think that this book, Beth's book that's coming out April 20th, is a really important book. So she has a book coming out called The Making of Biblical Womanhood. I'm sure you've probably seen it out there on the interwebs, but I just knew from the first time I saw what this book it was about and the subject matter that it was something that I wanted to talk to Beth about. And that's because she takes this whole complementarianism and egalitarianism, the biblical manhood and womanhood, and puts it into her field, which is medieval history. And we needed somebody to take this topic on, this really hard-fought topic in our culture. We needed somebody to take it on from a different perspective, and that's what Beth does in this book. She does talk about some of the Pauline stuff, some of the verses in there, and we get into that into this episode, but more of it is just Beth's story. Like, the reason that Beth is doing this book and writing on this stuff is because it's very personal, and you see just God's hand in her story and bringing her to write this book. And so we get into all the things in this episode. This is one of the longer episodes I've ever done, but there's so much here, so much good stuff. And Beth was so gracious with her time and sort of walking us through all of this. I actually embarrassed myself in this interview with my ignorance of medieval history, and I left all those parts in just so we make it understandable that it's okay not to know, and it's okay to be corrected, and it's okay to learn. And I think all those things are really important. So I think there's going to be a lot of stuff in here that you've never heard before and that you can learn from. So I hope you enjoy this interview. I highly encourage you to check out Beth's book, forthcoming from Brazos. Such good stuff. Before we get to the interview, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at A Theology of Hustle, and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with the podcast and everything we got going on. And I hope you enjoy hearing from Beth. All right. Well, Beth, thanks so much for making time for me and coming on the podcast. It's awesome to chat.
Yeah, it's great to be here. And I'm so glad to get to meet you outside of the Twitter sphere.
Right? I know. It's such a weird thing where you know people like in this, this social media space.
I know. So I always like to see faces and get to see if they really look like their profile pic,
Right. Totally agree. I did a lot of Photoshop on my profile pic, so it may look a little different. It's fine though.
Well, so I told them I had to stop using my beautiful pictures that were made right when I hit 40. And I was like, you know what? Things just go downhill really fast after 40. And I just don't look like that anymore. So
it's
had to accept the age.
It's one of those things. So, okay. So let's maybe start off and just have you do the quick intro for everybody.
Sure. So I am Beth Allison Barr, and I am a native Texan as well. I grew up in small town Texas. My dad was a army officer, and we moved to a small town in Texas right when he got out of the army. And now that I know as a historian, looking back, when we moved to Texas was right when everything in the evangelical world was changing, especially in regards to women's roles. And now, so I was on the front end. I was that first sort of group, that first sort of generation where the messaging was changing to women. And as a historian, I find this fascinating. Well, I'll talk about that later. But anyway, so I was on the front end of that change. So a lot of the really weird stuff didn't hit me directly. I was like out of youth group before we got all the weird purity culture stuff. Right. And I was sort of on the leading edge of all of these things. But it was something that was very formative in my mind. And what was interesting about it is that when I was a college student, I felt a very clear calling on my life to ministry as well as to academia. And I never actually knew how those things would work together until my junior year, when I met this guy in my biblical archaeology class who sat behind me and convinced me that the reason God was calling me to both was because he wanted to be a pastor. And I wanted to go into academia. And that's actually exactly what happened. I married him right before I started grad school, 10 days. And so we got thrown into the world of a liberal women's studies program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill while he started his MDiv at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. And so you talk about whiplash in our two lives. And I talk about this a lot in the book, but that was a very formative time for me, was this disconnect between what I was learning as a historian who was remaining faithful. I have never questioned my faith throughout any of this process. I have never once did I stop and say, is God real? Never lost that. But what I began to see was that the things that we thought were Christian were not.
Yeah.
That they were historically constructed. So that really was, in many ways, the making of biblical womanhood is my life.
Yeah.
From almost that very beginning. So
yeah. That's what I loved about the book.
No,
that's perfect. That's what I loved about the book. I mean, you see, like, through the book, and I mentioned this on Twitter, but like, it's the intertwining of your life and, you know, what's going on in the book and this deconstruction of, you know, these things that we built up as evangelicals. And like that, yeah, that's why I do this podcast. It's like the story, like God has built your story and like to do what you're doing right now. And that's why you're good at what you do. So.
Well, I don't know, but it is interesting. I've moved further and further away from Reformed theology the older that I've gotten, but it's funny that some things I still talk about as providential. And I do think that the strands of my life have been pulled together in a way so that I could do this at this moment.
Yeah, I love that. So before we jump into the book, because I have so many questions, I'm so interested, like, because you're a historian, you focus on medieval history.
I do.
Why
am I a medieval historian? Yeah. So this is a funny story. Okay, so I didn't tell much about this. But when I started off, I came to history through journalism. I was a journalist. I loved journalism in high school. I wrote for the newspaper. I was editor. I went to state, you know, writing. And so that was my plan, was to be a journalist and to be a professional writer. And what I found when I got to Baylor was that and I was a Baylor undergrad, was that history gave me the information I needed to be able to tell the stories I wanted to tell. And so I decided that I could be a professional writer, but grounded in history. And so I switched my major to history, stayed, and I actually added classics. I'm a classics undergrad person. So my original intent was actually to be a classics scholar.
Okay.
And what sort of changed my mind with that was, as I was thinking about going to graduate school, I read a book by a scholar named Judith Bennett on women in the medieval English countryside. And I got really fascinated by the stories of these women whose names don't appear. And what I realized is that if I was a classic scholar, the evidence for classical women is so scarce. I actually have a comment about this in my book where I talk about, you know, they're so hidden. It's really hard to have stories about classical women. So I wanted to be able to tell the stories of women we didn't know very much about and have evidence to tell those.
Sure.
That put me in medieval. Because that's where we have evidence of, so that's really it. It was about the story I wanted to tell. And I wanted to tell the story about ordinary Christian women. And so that launched me into the medieval world. And that's what I applied for in grad school. And that's what I've always done. So it's been, and I love it. And my primary research area is still the stories of ordinary women through religious literature. And that's what I study.
That's incredible, because I mean the book is about that, right? There's a lot of medieval history regarding women specifically.
It's so fun.
So I didn't realize that. I mean, I thought that was probably for the book, but you came into this like wanting to talk about women and bringing history together.
That's exactly it. Yeah, and that's why I did not stay a classics major.
Okay. Wow. That's interesting. So why do you felt? I mean, looking back, why were you so compelled to tell like average, like normal women's stories from the past?
So one of the things, and it's sort of interesting, I don't think I really came to this realization later on, but it's funny how, you know, pieces start coming together.
Sure.
And one of the things that always frustrated me about my history textbooks was how little they included women. This was something that, I had a professor at Baylor, and I used to annoy him because he would be like, okay, Beth's not going to like this because there's not women in it. and he would say that in class. But it frustrated me because I'm like, women are a part of the story. We know they're a part of the story. We just look around our lives now. And women are such, the church itself, women are the ones historically who have always gone to church more than men.
Yep.
Women are the ones who have always contributed more money than men. I mean, this actually is really fascinating. The regular contributors. I love the story where Jesus, talks about the woman who gave the last that she had. That was actually the start of my master's thesis. Master's thesis starts with that story. Talking about the fact that even though women have little to give, that was the name of my master's thesis, little to give, women always give. And that's, if you look at it, men may have more deeper pockets and richer amounts that they give the church, but women are the consistent. And so this fascinated me, even from a very young age, this fascinated women's consistency. I also grew up in a household of very strong women. My grandma was a West Texas farmer's wife. And cotton farmer, her husband didn't care that much about education, but she put herself through 2 master's degrees, through college and 2 master's degrees while running that farm. And she put all of her children through college. And my dad became a physician because of my grandma. He had never been, he talks about when he went to University of Texas at Austin and he'd never seen pizza before. It was like this, he has these really funny stories, but I came from a line of very strong women. My aunts are both, everybody in, all the women in my family have advanced degrees. Wow. So that's also in the background, I think, of why I had this sort of interest in women.
That's cool. I love that. That's cool. And I know the woman I know the type of women you're talking about, like growing up in West Texas. I know.
My dad, you grew up in Amarillo. My dad's from Rural.
I don't know
if you know where. Tiny. It's almost gone now.
Yeah.
But way out West Texas. So yeah. Anyway, that's my family's roots on his side.
I love that. It's good. It's good stuff. Okay. Let's jump into the book because I'm worried I'm not going to have enough time to ask you all the questions.
Sorry.
I could
talk a lot. That's the problem of having teachers on these things.
Yeah. Well, it's just so fascinating to me. And I guess what I'm worried about is that there's not just like one thing to talk about in this book. It's not like you just tell the history of women and that's it. Like you cover so much. I mean, we're talking like translations, like there's Greek, there's exegesis. Systematics. So
it was hard. It was hard. I cried over drafts of this chapter. I can tell you, Caitlin Beatty was my first editor and she is brilliant. It was hard. It was very hard to do this. And eventually what I did to do this is I wrote from my lectures. I was like, I'm teaching. That's what saved me up. When I had that epiphany, it was a moment. And I was like, I'm going to teach from my lectures. And so that's what I did. I went back to my lectures. I saw how I constructed my lectures when I was talking. And that's what I did.
Okay.
And then I interwove my story in it. So if that's helpful, that's what I did.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so let's jump into the why behind this book. I know we've kind of danced around it, but can you just talk about like what happened that, kind of caused all this?
Yeah, sure. So as I said, in the book, what you will see is that this wasn't an immediate revelation epiphany, that I had been growing more and more uncomfortable with the relegation of women in evangelical circles, evangelical spheres to not be able to preach. And I was on the leading edge of some of these changes, like when, Wayne Grudem and John Piper's book came out, their Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood came out when I was in high school, but I wasn't aware of it when I was in high school.
Right.
So, but these things were changing. So I was aware of these hardening roles, these attitudes towards women, at the same time that I was becoming more aware of women's real roles throughout history, especially women's activity in the church. And so these things have followed me for a long time. When my husband and I came to ministry, we came to a church that we knew didn't allow women to preach. But this had been the story of our lives. And so it didn't seem like a big deal to us at the time. I was sort of like, well, and we always sort of talked about it. And at the time, we actually weren't fully on board with it. Like, I wasn't opposed to it, but I wasn't like, this is definitely the way it should be.
Right.
I was still in that. It just wasn't a big deal to me. That's really it. It wasn't significant to me at the time. So we were like, well, we can just live with it. It's fine. It's not a big deal. So we did that for many, many years. But what we began to notice was a hardening in our church, that women began to be able to do less and less and less. And we were sort of protected because we were in youth ministry. And my husband was, we loved youth ministry. He was a really good youth pastor. And you've been in youth ministry too. And there's oftentimes it's a stepping stone to something else.
Yeah.
And he wasn't that way. And so we, in youth ministry, we were sort of protected because he could have people teach who we wanted to have teach. And so it didn't really affect us as much in youth ministry.
Right.
So we could still sort of live with it, but it was this growing disconnect. And it finally began when we lost our really good Sunday school teacher. And we had almost no one else. I mean, there, it's crazy about it. Nobody would step up. We didn't have anybody who was really good at it. And I was like, just let me teach. I'll just do it. And we thought I would be allowed to teach. And the line came down. It was like, no. She can only lead sermon question discussions. And that was when I remember this pit in my stomach. I was just like, oh. And at the same time, we also, my daughter was starting to get older, where she was starting to listen to, I mean, my son was starting to listen to the sermons. My daughter was a toddler, but she was, I remember getting a lesson that she had been taught in her children's class about what men and women are supposed to do in the church.
What?
And I was livid. I went, and this is actually, I was so livid. And it was also, somebody had given me Bruce Ware's book, which I talk about in the making of it. Somebody had given me that for her. And when I started reading the part about the Trinity, and I realized that they were actually using that book to teach her children's lessons, and I was just like, no. And I really did. I was just like, no. And I talked with my husband, with Jeb, about it. And that was when we sort of had this moment. We were like, can we still do this?
Mm.
And our thought was, let's try. Let's see what we can do. And we really thought we could get the church to move. I mean, my husband didn't. He was much more realistic. I'm an internal optimist. And I was like, surely they know us. They know how solid we are theologically. Surely they will listen. And they didn't. And my husband, it was a really horrific moment that scarred both of us for forever when he was essentially told to walk away that day with essentially a month's of pay. And they were going to leave the church with, essentially they were going to tell the church something that made it sound like he had done something.
Right.
And that was, I mean, it was just this, all it was a woman teaching Sunday school. And that was when I was like, mm-mm. It was that moment when he got fired that something changed for me. I didn't know yet what it was going to be, but I was done. And I was ready to do whatever it took to reclaim Jesus's vision for women, as well as Paul's vision. We've just gotten Paul dead wrong. So anyway, there you are. I can talk and talk, but I'll stop. I'll let you do the interview.
I appreciate you sharing that story. It spoke to me because I'm in a very healthy church for a lot of important reasons. That's the reason we stick around at our church, is because it is healthy. And it just, like, the abuse on ministers over stuff like this is just so hard. Like, I work with so many other pastors that have just experienced abuse in the church. And that's like
brutal.
That's what y'all experienced.
That's my next thing. I haven't quite gotten to it yet, but I'm actually going to start a series on the Anxious Bench on pastors.
Yeah.
And I've done it a little bit, but just talking, I mean, it's, you know, the thing that made me angriest about what happened was really what they did to my husband.
Right.
And that's the thing that I'm like, oh, I'm fine. I'm over it. And then I think about it and I get angry.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
So it was just, it was, you know, he's anyway.
Yeah. Something similar just happened with a woman who used to be on staff with me at our church. She moved away and she was working at another church and had the same issue. I actually like prepped her. I gave her all the info, not as much. I wish I would have had your book at this time, but I gave her, you know, all the arguments against, you know, complementarianism, and prepped her to go in front of her elders and argue. I mean, she's like a major leader in this church and they just basically told her to get out, you know, because
yep, that's exactly
this. Yeah.
They won't listen. And, and I'm not sure, which is why my final chapter, it's sort of me putting my hands up and saying, how are we going to change this?
Right.
We have to stand together and stand against it.
Yeah.
You know, if people in churches stopped accepting it, pastors would have to rethink.
Yeah, you're totally right. Okay. I don't even know where to start, to be honest with you. I guess. Okay. So I went to Moody for my undergrad. So, which is, you know, and
I know. Yep. I know. Okay. About Moody.
Okay. There's this picture cemented in my mind of this issue. Like I didn't grow up in church. I was 18 when I became a Christian. So I didn't grow up with a lot of that, like sort of cultural baggage.
How did you convert?
Well, when you were from Amarillo, like everybody's a Christian.
Okay.
You know, and so like my parents sort of went to church sparingly and all that stuff. And I was partying one night with a bunch of friends and just like realized the futility of it all, I guess. And I went home that night and I just said, Lord, my life is yours in my room. And like totally changed. Yeah, got a call to ministry a month later. And so I didn't know all of these issues were in the church. So Moody decides that we need to tackle this sort of egalitarian versus complementarian issue. So they decide to host a chapel. And what they do is they have two people, one representing the complementarian side, one representing egalitarian on the stage, sort of not a debate, but a conversation. And it turned into a disaster. Like all they did was just like yell at each other. I mean, it like devolved into where they just like had to shut down chapel. Like not knowing what was going on, it cemented for me that this conversation has become so impossible to have because it's so I don't even know why. It's just impossible to have, right?
That was really my feeling about it. And that was my husband and I, he's all behind this book. So people are like, why doesn't Jeb tell his story? And I was like, well, he kind of did. Actually wrote a couple of sentences for me that I couldn't figure out how to say it for a pastor to get it. And so he would write them and send them, you know, and say, what about this? And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's perfect. But anyway, the idea behind it, this is a thing that was growing in my mind while I was a grad student and as I've been an academic and as I've been teaching a women's history professor while going to a church that says women can't preach. I mean, just think about the disconnect. It's really crazy. But one of the things that I realized is that history can move this conversation forward. Mm. I mean, what's happened between complementarians and egalitarians is that they have gotten so entrenched in the biblical text and this argument that, and really for complementarians, the key issue is that they believe this is the only way to read the Bible.
Right.
And what they don't understand is that their reading of the Bible is created by historical circumstances that are not Christian. And so my thought as a historian was we've got to stop arguing about biblical text and we've got to see what's informing our understanding of biblical text and how that informing has taken place from the beginning of Christian history until now, which is what I do, which is crazy when you think about it in this book. But I actually originally was not going to talk about Paul. And my husband and I had like two or three arguments about this. He was like, Beth, they are not going to listen to you unless you talk about Paul. And I was like, but that's what the problem is that we can't get people to stop talking about Paul. They right. keep, and I don't know. So anyway, I finally was convinced that I needed to do it. And as I said, I wrote it from the way I wrote it from a particular class that I had, in which this became very important, a part conversation that we had, a women's history class. And so that class really is the way that I wrote that Paul chapter.
I love that. I love that. Okay. So let's go there then. So how do we, if you could just give, I know that's such a complicated thing, you know, but how do you feel like complementarians a lot of times misread Paul?
Yeah. So one of the best articles about this that I really think encapsulates Paul's vision is Beverly Roberts Gaventa. And she is an incredible, incredible New Testament scholar. I know a lot of people are simply not exposed to her, especially Christians, conservative Christians. She probably has a broader view of the theological view than many conservative Christians would accept, but that's okay. You don't have to accept all of her broader view without seeing the beauty of her vision within this. And essentially what she says, look, if you look at the patterns of what Paul is doing, he is not trying to set rules for how people should behave. I mean, he's not. What he's always doing is pushing against those and saying, we're being called to a bigger vision. Scott McKnight gets at this too, this bigger vision. We are being called to be like Christ. And the overarching narrative of Paul is that everybody does different things, but these different things change. They are not defined. I mean, that's the whole problem with reading Paul by saying women can't preach or teach, is that women do preach and teach in the early church. I mean, the whole fact that he gave Romans to Phoebe, and that Phoebe took it and read it. She was the first preacher of Romans.
Right.
That completely undermines any idea that Paul said women can't preach or teach. So it's, we've gotten so zeroed in on specific verses and we've plucked those verses out to read everything else by it, instead of looking to see what the overarching themes are. You know, we've lost the forest for the trees.
Yeah,
is what we have done. And we can't get past that because of the whole inerrancy battle. And because Christians like me were told that if you go down that slippery slope, you lose your faith.
Right.
And yeah.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because, I mean, what you're talking about, like with the inerrancy stuff and this sort of literal reading of the Bible, like, in quotations, nobody actually reads the Bible literally. I mean, you just can't. There's non-literal right. things in the Bible. There's metaphor, there's idioms. You cannot read it completely literally. And so I think a lot of people mean when they say literally is without any sort of context whatsoever, which like makes no sense. Like Paul's speaking into a specific time period to specific people, right? Like, and a lot of what you do is sort of break down some of these Greco-Roman yeah. backgrounds, right?
No, that's exactly. And the thing is too, is I think as, and this was the other big piece. I mean, this is a piece, one of the scholars who, you know, endorsed, and of course I've been just blown away by the people who, the responses I received to this, but one of them wrote to me and was like, I didn't know the Reformation piece. He was yeah. like, I didn't know that. And that was the thing too, as evangelicals, is we have to realize how much our current understanding is informed by the Reformation, the 16th and 17th centuries. And that's a piece that I think we forget that, you know, as I said, one of the comments that I make is that the cult of true womanhood is not actually anything. It's not anything new. The biblical womanhood is simply the cult of true womanhood, just reinvigorated. And actually, I think a lot of this goes back to homeschooling texts and Christian texts that were used in conservative circles that brought up, that kept teaching these ideas about what it means to be a woman. And that became part of, seen as part of Christianity. So
yeah,
that's a whole nother story. I wasn't able to tell that story.
There's so many threads to all of this. And just as evangelicals, I love that you're a historian approaching this conversation, because I feel like it's what is needed in this conversation, because evangelicals tend to only think that like Christianity like existed in the last like 40 or 50 years.
Yep.
You know, it's like our view of the history of theology and the history of the church is very limited.
And the thing is, too, is that we are so Augustinian in our understanding. You know, we think, it seems his ideas about original sin and his ideas about how that it is transmitted through human sexuality, right, through the human sex. I mean, that is, it's like, why are we still following that? And that's one of the things that has done a lot of damage to women. These ideas that women's bodies are less have to do with this Aristotelian and Augustinian framework that for some reason we can't walk away from. So I don't understand that either, but
yeah, this might be an aside. Something I was curious about as I was reading, I know you're a medieval scholar. I was surprised, or how much does Aquinas play into like this rebirth of Aristotelianism? And
that's really funny. Okay. So as you've already found, I'm a social historian, which means I don't care about important people. Okay. I tell that to my students all the time. And one of my pet peeves is Thomas Aquinas,
okay,
as a medieval historian, because Thomas Aquinas, the reason we think Thomas Aquinas is important is because the 19th century thought Thomas Aquinas was important. They decided they liked, there are some pieces of Aquinas that are important, okay? Yeah. His understanding of the Eucharist is vitally important, and that did feed into some significant medieval that ordinary people would have known. But for the vast majority of medieval Christians, Thomas Aquinas was not was very insignificant. Hmm. He was not, you know, they would be much more familiar with Augustine, with John Chrysostom, who were quoted. They would be much more familiar with the stories of the Golden Legend. These are the church, you know, these are the voices that they would hear repeated in their sermons. Aquinas, not so much.
Yeah.
So it's a running joke I have, because we're like, because everybody thinks Aquinas is super important to medieval faith. And I mean, there's piece of, I don't want to downplay him.
Yeah.
You know, his understanding of the Eucharist is very significant, but at the same time, he does not play the role that we think he has played. So I always think it when people tell me they're doing a medieval theology course and they're focusing on Aquinas, I just roll my eyes. I'm just like, that's not medieval theology. I'm like, that's Thomas Aquinas. And I was like, if you want to do medieval theology, you've got to do a much broader scope. And that's, you know, the stories we tell, how we tell the stories we tell matters. And that's what I'm interested in, is why we tell stories certain ways and the history about why we tell those stories a certain way. So Thomas Aquinas is a 19th century story that we keep telling.
Interesting. I like that. I really appreciate that. I was trying to think, I took a class in medieval theology, but heck, I, you know, that one kind of whizzed by me a little bit, I think. So
I have a nice little handout on basic medieval theology that I can send to you.
I would love that. It's been a while, because, you know, I mean, you have the councils happening in ancient theology, right? And
yeah,
you have a lot of movement happening. Then you have the Great Schism. And then like, there's just this kind of, I mean, they call them the Dark Ages. And, you know, I guess we don't learn as much about that time period as other time periods.
So I'll tell you, the Dark Ages is also a 19th century construction. The only viable use of the term Dark Ages is actually for the period after, in the ancient Greek world, after the fall of Minoan culture, there is a time period that we don't know a whole lot, up from like the 13th century BC to about 800. We don't know, we can't see it. And so that period is a sort of a Dark Ages, but the reason it was applied to the medieval world was by 19th century scholars who thought medieval people were backwards. And so it's a derogatory term. So if you said that in my classroom, I would say, okay, let's talk about that. But that's it. It's a derogatory term applied to the medieval world by 19th century folk who thought they were a lot better.
I, yeah. Well, I apologize. I did not mean to offend. So you'll have to excuse my ignorance. So, but I like to learn. So I think that's more what it's about, right? So,
yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay. I'm really interested in the medieval side of things because,
right.
I mean, even the women that you bring up, can you talk a little bit just about the women that you talk about in medieval times?
Yeah, I would love to talk about that. And one of the things that I had to do for this book, and I don't know if I'm going to talk a little bit more about it next spring when the book is starting to come out, but I had to make very conscious choices about what I included and what I didn't include because I couldn't include everything. So I had to tell, I told the things that I thought would be the most significant that would, and I tried to highlight the scholars that I thought could help, you know, just a few of them. I couldn't cover everyone.
Right.
But I did that also with medieval women. And as I said, on the one hand, I actually am mostly interested in medieval women who don't have voices. So I'm interested in the women who may only come up one or two times in the records for their names, but we know they were part of parish churches, et cetera. But one of the women whose name does come up in my book a lot that I pay a lot of attention to is, of course, Marjorie Kemp. And Marjorie Kemp is quite extraordinary, as well as ordinary. She kind of covers both of those things. And she's this 15th century woman who's sort of middling class a little bit. And one of the things that my students always find fascinating about her, and it's covered really fast in the beginning of her autobiography, which is the first autobiography, you know, we have of a medieval woman like this. I mean, so it's really a fantastic, there's one also, we have a Japanese autobiography too, but nonetheless, but for England. But she actually owns a couple of her own businesses. She owns the purse strings in her family. And she actually has the control over that, which her husband doesn't have. She married down she married a lower class guy. And so she actually has the economic and political clout in their marriage, which always sort of surprises my students because when they think about medieval women, they think about women really, they really kind of think about it in a 1950s way where women's identities are completely subsumed by their husbands, that when they sign their check, they sign it, you know, with their husband's name. And they kind of think about medieval women that way. And even though the medieval world's not a golden age for women, but at the same time, women are able to function and have their own business identities and economic identities and even hold the purse strings, although they're never as wealthy as men. So Marjorie Kemp really drives that home for my students. Marjorie Kemp is also somebody who hears the lessons of the medieval church and uses them to do what she thinks God is calling her to do. She's not somebody you would want to sit next to in church because she's very loud and she spends a lot of time crying and screaming and doing, you know, sort of wild things in churches. So she gets thrown out of sermons a lot. But the reason she does these things is because she hears stories about women who did these things and she hears stories that God has called women to do these things. And so she copies it. And she does that, and she believes God calls her. And what's really interesting about her is that nobody faults her for her theology. You know, she goes even before the Archbishop of York and gets quizzed, and he's like, I can't find any theological fault with her. You know, she has understood medieval theology and medieval Christianity enough that she is able to argue with ecclesiastical authorities. And they're like, she's good. You know, she's not a heretic. She gets this. And this includes her being able to argue and being able to preach. I mean, she quotes scripture and she's essentially a street preacher. And it's so, and she's allowed, medieval theology makes room for her and allows her to do this. So she's a really great story for my students to show how these modern ideas about women in the church are very much, you know, are culturally constructed. And so she always provokes great. So I love talking about her. One of the women that got cut from my book was a woman named Hilda of Whitby, who I also loved talking about. And Hilda presided over a double monastery in England in the 7th century. And she presided over one of the most significant church councils in England, which was deciding the date of Easter. And I mean, you know, and so she has the king and she has all of these major ecclesiastical figures and they all come to her and she presides over this major theological and political moment. And this, I mean, you just think about the significant role that she played here and was allowed to play here. And she, you know, and so just clearly our understanding of what women could do in the church and what has changed over time.
Yeah, it's just,
so, is that helpful?
No, it's super helpful. I was blown away, to be honest with you. I mean, I've done a lot of study in historical theology. I have a degree in that. And to like have no idea about any of this stuff, because in my mind, it's the same narrative I'm sure you encounter with students all the time, which is just that, you know, women have always existed in this sort of, you know, oppressive patriarchy, right? Where they're not allowed to do anything, right?
Well, and that's, I mean, you know, that was the hardest thing about this book, is that this book is both shows the change and continuity in women's lives. And right. One of the continuities is that women are always, they're not ever able to do the things that men are able to do in the same ways.
Right.
So women always have to do it for qualified reasons. And there's, you know, as I really, in the Reformation chapter, I talk about it with Virginia Woolf's A Room of Their Own, and that women's room sizes change. And that's really a good picture I found for my students to use, is that there are always more, there's always more constraints around what women do, but sometimes those constraints are less, and sometimes those constraints are more, which also tells me as a historian that the constrictions are on women are not Christian. They come from outside. They come from history. They come from people. So that's something else, is the continuity of patriarchy, I think, is the biggest challenge to complementarian narrative. But the problem is that complementarians won't let us tell that story,
right?
Because they exclude women from their textbooks, from their seminary teachings. And so if you exclude women from the narrative, then you miss this piece. And that's what they've done. I mean, they've written the texts, as I say, they are written by men for men about men. And that's why women can't get ahead.
I totally agree with that. And I think back to my education. I had such a good education, right? And in so many ways, but the focus on women in theology was not one of those ways, you know?
No.
And so,
It's not. And the thing is too, is like in seminary, if you want to learn about that, you have to take a course on women.
Right.
They're not part of the regular course teachings.
Right.
And so it's the segregating, women are always other. And that means that we are always put in the secondary place. So.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree. It's sad. And so purity culture has this idea that men are lustful and women are supposed to, you know, cover themselves. You have a great story in your book about an experience with that.
Yeah.
And I even found, you know, the history of like sexual appetite and how that has like transformed. And we have this one narrative where men have always been like this and, you know, women have always been a certain way. And you like talk about how that's not true either.
Right. No, it is. It's very interesting. This idea that women were, you know, today we think about that men are always the aggressors and that men are the ones with the higher sexual appetites. That's sort of the story that we tell. That's the story we tell our sons. We tell them that this is, you know, if you think about every man's battle, which, oh my gosh, but that's the narrative that is told to little boys, is that they can't control the sexual voraciousness that's inside of them, and that women don't have this to the same degree. And the fact is that, you know, medieval people, they actually had a different, there was this idea where we see these sexually voracious women. And this is something that I talk about in my class too. I didn't get to talk about clothing, but we talk about how female purity, you know, culture. And we also talk about, we think about the things that women wear that emphasize, we often think about women as dressing more to attract mates.
Right.
But medieval men did this. And, you know, my students love, we talk about how tight their tights got and how short their waistcoats got. You know, there was and the implements that they use to make their body parts look more than they were. Mm. We also talk about their shoes. Men's shoes get really long and pointy. Mm. And it's sort of this idea that those that have, the longer their shoes are and the pointier their shoes are, that they suggest something about the sexual nature of the man. And so we see these emphasis on male clothing in the 14th and the 15th century, which is these things are culturally constructed. And Christians don't like to hear that, because when we hear things are culturally constructed, what we hear is that God's not true. And that's not at all what it means. Right. It means that history is created by people. God is outside of history. He's part overarching, but history is made by people. So when we say things are culturally constructed, we say they're made by people. And Christians confuse this all the time. I can't tell you about how I could not get through when my church did that was another turning point for me, was when they did the focus on the family, the truth. I didn't look this up before because it just popped in mind, but they did that whole thing on the truth project. Wasn't that what it was called? The Truth Project? It was horrific. It was just horrific in how they talked about postmodernism and this idea of cultural construction, and how this suggested that God wasn't real. And if you bought into postmodern narratives, then you were buying into the fact essentially that would lead to atheism. And it was just horrific to me that that was being told to Christians, because it's not true.
Right.
So
I love the scare tactics, right? When I was when I was in undergrad, the emergent church was going to destroy the whole of the church. The Da Vinci Code was about to take down the entire church all at once,
Yes.
That totally happened. The Da Vinci Code is my Bible now. So,
Well, the Da Vinci Code is based upon a medieval story about Mary Magdalene. And medieval people did believe that she was a preacher that went to France. The part about her being married to Jesus, no. That's a Gnostic, but anyway, that's a whole other thing. But that was interesting to me about the Da Vinci Code, that it actually brought up a piece of medieval Christianity that has been lost by our modern church. But it was a very prevalent narrative, and medieval people believed it, that Mary Magdalene brought salvation to France, and she preached, and her sister Martha killed a dragon on the beach.
That's awesome. I mean, right? Yeah, it's pretty legit.
Name your kids Martha. They can be dragon slayers.
Hey, that's awesome. One of my favorite parts about it, I'm an exegesis guy. I love talking about that sort of stuff, was your talk about the translations of the Bible.
Okay. Yeah. So I can tell this story. This is actually one of the first things. And what's really funny is this is when my academic world, and the part of this too is the perspective of historians themselves in academia. And a lot of academic historians simply don't get the evangelical perspective, because they're mostly not evangelicals. That doesn't mean they're mostly not Christians. I actually know a lot of women's historians who are fantastic and very strong Christians. They are just not in the evangelical tradition. So that's I think an important piece. But the evangelical understanding of the Bible is really shaped by the inerrancy battles of the fundamentalist modernist controversy, which I didn't care anything about until I realized the importance it had for women. Mm-hmm. And that was when, I started putting the pieces together. But it was this understanding that the Bible is this, that we have to read the Bible, that there's really only one way to read the Bible. That's really what inerrancy kind of comes across, is that there's only one way to read the Bible. And if you don't read the Bible that way, then you don't believe.
Right.
And so to me, so this leads to things, and I talk about it in the book. I can't tell you how I really did almost fall out of my chair when I read the Capitol Hill church history survey that they were teaching in their Sunday schools. And I read the sections on the medieval church, and I was just so livid. But essentially their idea is that medieval people didn't know their Bible. And the reason they came to that was for two things. One, because we don't have a whole lot of copies of the medieval Bible running around out there. The second reason is because I think it has to do with this whole piece of inerrancy, that medieval people read the Bible differently. And so therefore they could not be Christians.
Right.
And this really came together. And so essentially what they were arguing was from 500 to 1500 that there were very few people who believed in Jesus. And that, I mean, that is such a sad narrative.
That is audacious.
To actually believe that. Right. And I'm just sitting here and I'm like, you don't know how many sermons I have read. And these people believe in Jesus. They believe Jesus died for them and that their sins are forgiven and that they will get to spend, you know, they believe everything important about the gospel.
Yeah.
But they're being written out of these evangelical stories because of our understanding of how we read the Bible. And as I said, and I'm actually pretty theologically, I hate using the word conservative or liberal because I don't like those terms,
right.
But I'm pretty, I believe the Bible is fully trustworthy. Let's just put that. I believe the Bible is fully trustworthy. I like that word. Ben Witherington gave me that word. So I like that word.
That's a good word. Yeah.
So I believe the Bible is fully trustworthy. And as I said, my faith has never daunted throughout any of this. But what I begin to find in that when I came, in the late 90s and early 2000s is when I became aware of these battles over the Bible. And one of the first Bibles that my husband actually gave me, he gave me two Bibles early on. One of them was one that I could carry around with me, and it was a New Living Translation. I love the New Living,
yeah.
You know, so more of a paraphrase, but I still mm-hmm. love it. And then he also gave me a copy of the TNIV. And then the third Bible that I got while I was in grad school was the 1611 KJV. And so those were the three Bibles that I used.
Mostly,
yeah, yeah. Those are my three that I start. I still have all three of them. And I use them. But that one of the things that I begin looking at those texts, it becomes really apparent that there are differences in how we talk about women and men and the inclusion of just simply including the word women. I mean, I'm not talking about God,
right?
Not talking about any, I'm just talking about including, instead of saying brothers, we say brothers and sisters,
right?
Those types of things. At the same time that I'm starting to become aware of this and reading the differences in these three Bibles that I use, I'm also starting to read medieval sermons. And the person that I started working on is a guy named John Merck. He was a Augustinian friar out in the very west of England. I could tell you a whole lot about him that you probably don't care about. But anyway, he wrote what became the most popular sermon collection in England called The Festial. And one of the things that I began to realize, the first copy I started working with from John Merck was a later copy of his text. There's a lot of manuscript versions of Festial. And so this one was actually one that was made after 1425, around 1425. And one of the things that I noticed as I read through it is that it used inclusive language a lot. And it used it when it paraphrased the Bible. This was really fascinating to me. And then I moved to another set of sermons called the Dominican, it's a Dominican sermon cycle, but it overlaps. It has a lot of festival sermons. You know, preachers kind of went around and they pulled together sermons from different collections that they liked and they made their own collections. You know, preachers have been the same throughout history. So they go around and so they pull together these pieces. And so this Dominican sermon cycle brings in some of these festival texts. And so that's how I started reading it. And one of the things that I noticed in this Dominican sermon cycle is that it really included women when it translated scripture. So it would read the scripture in the Latin, it would have it there for the priest, and then it would have the paraphrase of it that you could read out to the people. And the paraphrase would be gender inclusive. Mm. And as I said, this is really common. It's really hard for me just to pick up a Middle English sermon and not find this in it, especially ones that were used preaching, you know, to ordinary people. And so that really began to struck me at the same time, as I said, we start seeing all of this, you know, the controversy over the TNIV gets really harsh in the early 2000s,
yeah.
All of this fallout. We have the ESV about to be, and I'm sitting here. And in fact, one of the earliest conference papers I gave was actually on this. I'm like, look, everyone's getting all upset about gender inclusive language in Bibles, and medieval people have been doing this, you know, for a very long time. And so that was one of the very first conference papers I gave, was noting this difference And so, but then of course the disconnect with modern, with sort of modern scholars, it was sort of funny as I would say this to modern scholars and they would be like, well, yeah, of course they do that. I don't understand why that matters. You know, sort of, I'm like, this really matters to evangelical people because they don't know this. They don't, you know, what we know that is so common, the church doesn't know.
Yeah.
Because it's not in, and so that was part of this. It's just, and in fact, the very first chapter I wrote for The Making of Biblical Womanhood was that chapter on English Bible translations.
I loved it. I appreciated it so much. I wanted to show you my, my TNIV. That's always, this is the only Bible I preach from.
Really?
Well, because why would I stand up in front of a group of men and women and talk about passages that say, dear brothers?
Well, you know, and this is my theory behind it. You know, the medieval world is not a non-patriarchal world. Right. Women were disadvantaged in so many ways. And so it's not a golden age, whatever. But in the church, because of the priest, medieval men and women both had to come to the priest as individual souls. And so when the priest preached to them, he didn't preach to them as family units. He preached to them as people.
Right.
And the women would sit on one side and the men on the other. And so I think that's why they do it, because they're looking out at their congregation and they're saying to the men and to the women. And so I think that's why they're doing it. And so when they're translating the scripture to them, they're saying, oh yes, Jesus came for the men and for the women. I think it's just an extension of the normalcy of medieval Christianity, this recognition, which is also why it is so frustrating to me that modern Christians find it offensive. I mean, it's just, it's like, why?
No sense of history and just, there's so much there that frustrates me. But even because I was in school during all of that controversy going on. Like Joe Stoll, who was the president of Moody at the time, like was a big champion for ESV. When the ESV came out, there was like applause going on, you know, in chapel and stuff, you know. So I've been in the height of all of this stuff, but I'm a biblical languages major and an exegesis major, you know what I mean? Like, you know the original text and you know where all these passages are coming from and the reasons behind all of that. And I stuck by my MIT and IV like through grad school, like being mocked by people for gender inclusive language. And just like, I don't understand. So.
Yeah. And if you actually go, as I said, I'm not a biblical scholar. And I always try to tell people that. But even if you know anything about the biblical languages, English does not translate biblical language as well.
Nope.
It doesn't. English is not a good language to translate biblical languages. And so every time we read our English Bibles, people have made major choices about what those words are, because they simply don't translate well. Now the good news is that the gospel of Jesus has never changed despite all of our, you know, Amen. All of this, but it does greatly affect things like what women and men can do in the church. And those are choices. They're not things original. I hate even using the word original, but they are not the way that they are interpreted and translated today are not the way that people in biblical times heard those texts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or medieval people heard those texts.
Right. And I think that's why it's important to use a multitude of translations. You know, if you're using English Bibles, like you have to be in many translations. And I think that's just how you have to do a serious Bible study. You talk about English though, even though that English does not have a plural for you, the second person, is insane.
Right? I know.
Like all of Paul's letters are not written to you. They're written to y'all. You know,
I know that Texans have the solution for it.
Exactly. Exactly. But I think we read individualism specifically into the text because of that.
And that's also a product of us being Americanists, you know, because we live in American culture, which is so individual oriented that we don't understand community oriented world.
Right.
And that the early biblical world was community oriented.
Yeah. Yeah. So much good stuff, Beth. I like Arianism, like you get into like actual heresies in this book. You covered so much stuff, so much ground. It is crazy.
You know, one of my tasks that I've had I've been a professor. I've been teaching in the college classroom since 1998. I started my PhD. I started my master's program at Chapel Hill in 97. And I started teaching the next year in the classroom. And one of the first classes that you teach is either Western Civ or world history. Now I mostly would teach world history. World history from the beginning of history to 1500 of the Common Era. And I mean, so I have been teaching this much history in a single semester since 1998.
Not your first rodeo, as they say.
I think, you know, it's hard. It was really hard. The conceptualization of this project was really hard. And at first I tried to like skate around it. When I first sent my proposal, when Caitlin Beatty and I were going back and forth about the proposal, I actually tried to get around doing it chronologically. I tried to do it theoretical. And she was like, nah, not going to work. Do it chronological. You got to do it. And I was like, okay, I was trying to cheat. I was trying to not teach my world history to 1500 class, but then I was like, okay, I've got to do it. So I went back. And as I said, what saved me was framing it by my, how I teach my class. So that's why I was able to do it, was because I've been teaching courses like this for so long.
It's an incredible work, Beth. And I don't say that lightly, as you've seen by my nerding out, but I think it's a real benefit to the church. And I think it's really important stuff. So I just want to encourage you in that. I know it's very vulnerable to put out something like this, but it's important work. So thank you.
I do appreciate that. Yeah. There was a lot of soul searching on, did I really want to say these things? But the bottom line of it is that I have spent most of my life not telling my fellow Christians what I know.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's time, because this matters.
I totally agree.
So
yeah, it's good. That's good. Okay. Well, are you okay jumping into the final two questions here, Beth?
Sure.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
So, okay, I was talking about that. I asked my husband, I was like, oh my gosh, he's asking me what my strangest job is. and my husband just kind of stared at me. But so I have worked all of my life. As I said, I came from my family has a very strong work ethic. And I married a man who has a very strong work ethic. So we have done a lot of different things throughout our lives. And I was kind of thinking about it, and I was like, well, I could tell you about when I was in college. One of the ways that I worked through college was I wrote the newsletter for one of the local high schools. And so I actually wrote their quarterly newsletter for them. It was sort of like this little newspaper thing. And I wrote it every 3 months, and they paid me to do that. That was actually fantastic. That's how I got like my spending money in college. But I actually think maybe my strangest job, or the job that maybe people wouldn't realize so much, is what I've done as a faculty member. Okay. Because one of the things I do right now is I live as a faculty in residence. And so my family, we sold our house and we moved into a 2,000 square foot apartment in a dormitory with a little over 300 students. And that's where we live. And so we like live in the middle of all of these undergraduates. We've been doing it during COVID too. And it's really been fantastic. And one of the things I do with these students is I lead them on walking tours, because I love sharing history. I love doing things like this. Part of what I've gotten to do as a faculty member is teach classes abroad. And so one of the classes that I teach in England is called Medieval Castles. And so I take students on walking tours to 17 different castles in England across a 5-week period. And so I kind of brought that to Waco. And so I do these walking tours for my undergraduate students, which are so much fun. I did a ghost tour, a Halloween ghost tour for students on Baylor campus. And that was one of the most fun things I've done in a long time. But so I think, I don't know if that gets at it, but I love doing those types of things. And so it's a really fun part of my job. But maybe, you know, I always kind of joke that if I decide to retire or do something else, I can start leading walking tours, you know, for people. And that would actually be very fulfilling and fun. So
it seems like a pretty good gig. I've been so jealous of your walking tours on Twitter. Like even uncovering racism, you know, in the history. And yeah.
Oh yeah. I'm going to do that one in February. You know, Waco's weird. It's one of the, it was the second place in the U.S. to have a legalized district for prostitution. It was called Two Street, and it lasted until 1917 when the MacArthur Army fort came to Waco base, MacArthur Army base came to Waco, and then they had to close it down. So that's one of the things that I do is I talk about Two Street a lot. I get a lot of material from what happened on Two Street. And it actually cut across, it cut to Baylor campus. So it's not there anymore. It's completely erased from Waco's history. So it's fun. I love doing the walking tours. And I love living with students. As I said, that may be something that people, a few universities have faculty and residence programs, and Baylor has 15 faculty and residence. And so that's maybe is a strange job. I don't know.
That's incredible. That's a cool way to connect with your students though, on a personal level. And yes. I think that's cool stuff. I love that.
Yeah. So. It's a natural extension of youth ministry.
Yeah, totally is. That's yeah. Yeah. That was a whole nother thing as I was reading your book, like just how much youth ministry you did throughout your years and that like you were a pastor's wife. I'm sure that's how it was referred. And yeah, my wife and I have always been, that's the beauty of where we're at. We've always been the youth pastors and, you know,
that's the thing that I think still, we love what we're doing now. I love, you know, my husband has grown into being a pastor preaching every Sunday, which is not why he got into, you know, in the beginning, that's not why he got into ministry. Right. But he's done a really incredible job with that. But I think both of us still miss youth ministry. That was actually one of the hardest things that happened was having to leave youth ministry. And I still regret that because we just loved it.
Yeah.
So
that's cool.
Living with college students has helped heal that a little bit.
Totally. Yeah. There's a lot of mentorship that goes on there.
Yes. And
yeah. Mm-hmm. That's cool. I love that. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Yes. So one of the things that I have written about a lot with my work with graduate students, talking with women, mentoring teenage girls, is simply the virtue of perseverance. And I think one of the things that I've seen in ministry, you know, a lot of people don't make it in ministry for very long. They check out after 5 years, they check out at the 10-year mark, they become burned out. I can't tell you how many pastors I've talked with, both my husband and I, who and their families. And it's being a pastor is so hard. I don't think people really understand how hard it is to be a pastor and to be a pastor's family and to be in ministry like that. I think the biggest piece of advice is we've got to have that kingdom perspective, that God's focus has never been large numbers. It's never been large amounts of money. It's never been the people who matter the most in high society or matter the most in local Waco. It's not, you know, the people that matter to God are the people who need him. And those are often the people that the church, you know, churches that are successful are the churches that are mostly composed of successful people, the people who make the most money, the people whose lives aren't falling apart, or at least, you know, hide it really well. Those are the people who we see going to the successful churches. But the people who God is always reaching out to are the people who don't count in those groups, the people who don't have the money, the people who are broken, the people whose lives are falling apart, the people who everything bad that could happen happens to them. And there aren't enough ministers reaching out to those people because you don't get paid enough, because it's not something that's deemed important. When we think about a successful pastoral ministry, it usually starts with small church, moves up to middle church, and then you move up to the high church where you're making $120,000 a year. And that's a successful ministry. But what about the pastors who stay with those congregations that are broken and are falling apart and stay with those churches until those churches have to close those doors? Aren't those people just as successful in the kingdom of God, because they are continuing to minister and to bring the love of God to the people who don't have anyone else? And so my advice would be, don't measure your success or your worth based upon the success of the American dream or the success of money or the success of large congregations. Base it on the way that Jesus did it. And it's to the least of these.
Amen.
Yeah. So I would say perseverance and not letting your worth be judged by the worth of mega churches and how big your salary is. Let it be judged by what God judges it. And it's doing his work to the people who need it the most.
I love it. Preach. That's good stuff. Such good stuff. I always say that Jesus had like the least successful ministry of anyone on earth. He died with his entire people rejecting him.
Yes.
You know, and so what does success really
look
like?
I have a post coming about pastors, you know, because you see this. I mean, most pastors pastor in small churches.
Yeah.
And most pastors pastor for salaries that are under 40K. And many, many of those pastors watch their church close while they are over it. And they're not failures. They are doing the hardest job of all. And so, as I said, I'm turning my attention after this to pastors.
I love it.
So there you are.
Good stuff. Beth, it was so good to connect and just read your work and just thank you for what you're doing. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for asking me. And I hope you got what you wanted. So I look forward to this coming out, and thank you. Thank you for putting my book out there too. I appreciate that.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Beth and just about her story and seeing how God played out this story and how all that feeds into what she does today. I think it's incredible. I always love hearing about that from people. I highly encourage you to go check out her book. Grab it. It's already been in its second printing even before it's come out. So there's a lot going on with this book. It's an important work that I think we need to be interacting with and dealing with. So I highly encourage you to go check it out. Make sure you're following Beth on all the socials. All that stuff is in the show notes for you, just so you can get there easily. Now is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review there that just helps get the word out about the podcast. I greatly appreciate you doing that. It just lets me know you're enjoying it and other people know other people are listening, and that always helps out a ton. So do all that for me, and until next time, get out there and hustle.